Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. By popular demand, by which I mean my wife said, you have to have Tim Miller back on the podcast. Tim Miller joined us again on the Bulwark Podcast.
Good to talk to you, Tim. Follow Rick Wilson. I have not listened to yesterday's pod yet because I didn't want to get in my head about how many F-bombs I needed to drop and how many creative curse words and attacks I needed to come up with in order to just get near that level. So I'm a little disappointed in my slotting.
No. I don't think that there were too many F-bombs, and I thought that think of that as an hors d'oeuvre for your appearance, right? Just sort of like, you know, we'll pass around some hors d'oeuvres and then we'll usher everyone in. Now the main event, Tim Miller.
I like it when my hors d'oeuvres is when you have kind of a very boring, heavy podcast, you know, and then I can bring the energy the next day, but that's okay.
I try to avoid the boring, heavy podcast. I don't
I wasn't going to name anybody.
I know. I try to avoid doing it, but it's like, you know, actually how I shouldn't admit this. After Rick Wilson was not a boring, heavy podcast. In fact, we've had some really lively ones this week. But
been a good week.
My impulse is when there is one to go, Miller, we need to get Tim Miller back on. So just so you know, okay. So
bring out the clown.
Known around the office as Tim Miller, not just another pretty face. So
exactly,
we don't actually have an office anymore. Okay, you have this fantastic but incredibly annoying piece, annoying about the, because of the substance, and infuriating would be a better word, about the spineless Tennessee Republicans who's on the ballot today, a candidate for the United States Senate, which is one of those stories that, okay, we know spineless Republicans have done that story. There's something about this story that's particularly enraging, and I want to get to it, but you and I have to do something first. We have to talk about Jerry Falwell the Lesser.
No.
Falwell the Lesser. I actually talked with Tom Nichols about this when the picture first appeared, and I wrestled for about, two, 3 minutes with the question, is this Photoshop? Is that really Jerry Falwell Jr., leading evangelical Christian supporter of Donald Trump, president of Liberty University, posing with this woman with his pants unzipped, you know, and his belly hanging out? And I know I'm a little bit fixated on this, but I was willing to let it go.
It's an arresting photo, Charlie. I just have to admit, it was hard to look away from it. It's just like a bizarre piece of art that you just have to stare at for a minute and really take in, just to see his sunburnt belly hanging over his underwear.
Jerry Falwell Jr.'s navel is like burned into my retina. I mean, this is the problem. It's you just can't. I got some criticism. People said, why are you talking about that? There's more important things to talk about, because as if we wouldn't normally talk about that. But I was willing to let it go, okay? Until, and this is what you and I have to deal with here. Jerry Falwell Jr., who is the president of a university, a Christian university, who is very high profile, right? On the Christian right? Fair enough. So he posts this picture on Instagram, which goes viral because it is so horrifically fascinating. Like, what the hell are you doing? He deletes it, but then, of course, has to explain what it was about. So he calls into this radio station, and our colleague Jim Swift tweeted about it, like, what did I just listen to? But this is Jerry Falwell Jr. on, I should know what radio station this is, he calls into a radio station and offers his explanation for the picture. All right, let's play it.
And I'm just going to throw it to you. What was up with that picture on Instagram?
You know, it was weird because she's pregnant, so she couldn't get her pants up. And so I was like trying to like my I had on a pair of jeans that I haven't worn in a long time, so I couldn't get mine zipped either. And so I just put my belly out like hers, and it was just she's my wife's assistant and she's a sweetheart, and I should never put it up because it embarrassed her, because anyway. I've apologized to everybody, and I promise my kids I'm gonna try to be a good boy from here on out.
All right. So, and this is it with this TV show, this Trailer Park Boys thing.
Yeah, whatever. It was the costume party on the, and we were on vacation, and anyway, long story short, it was just in good fun. That's it.
So that clears it up, right, Tim?
When was that? When did that radio program air?
Like yesterday, right?
Like at night? Was that like a late night show?
Are you going to imply that maybe he was a little bit impaired when he called into that show?
I don't know for sure what he sounds like sober and drunk. I haven't spent a lot of time with Jerry Falwell Jr., but that sounded like a slur, not a drawl to me.
See, this is the thing that, okay, bear with me just for a second here. You've dug yourself this terrible hole. It's really humiliating. It's humiliating for your family. It's humiliating for your school. You might actually have to answer to your board of trustees. And this is your make good on this to call in and, you know, I mean, look, I'm not suggesting. Yes, I am. The guy was sloshed. He calls into a radio station and he's sloshed. What the heck? What is going on with Jerry the Lesser? I don't know.
Can I just preempt this just by saying, please, just as a matter of principle, as somebody who enjoys a few cocktails and enjoys a boat party, God bless Jerry Falwell. He should be out there getting hammered on a boat and taking really weird and creepy pictures. I hope I'm doing that when I'm in my 60s. But his school, the hypocrisy is so jarring that, you know, the English language doesn't give you enough words for it. I mean, the rules at Liberty. I did a campaign in right out of college in Virginia, and you know, had a friend who was going to Liberty. You know, you can't even go into a female dorm as a male at Liberty. You can't have a single, you know, piece of alcohol on campus. You know, and so how do these students look at him, you know, having this kind of like gross swingers party on a boat? Like, justify the choices that they are being forced to make while their, you know, friends are going to colleges and partying and having a good time. It is Trumpian, you know, but Trumpian it's even kind of worse, honestly, because Trump doesn't like, you know, pretend, you know, that people should follow some moral code.
When he doesn't drink, this is why we do the podcast in the morning, right? I mean, it's Central Time. It's 9 o'clock. You're on the coast, so it's like 7 o'clock in the morning. We do this so that we are not going to be doing the podcast completely drunk. Can you imagine if I came on? And our guest today is Rick Wilson. And Rick, how you doing, man? Can you imagine the crap we would take if we did? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe that would be a thing. Drunken podcasts with the Bulwark folks. Maybe after the election. Right?
I'm interested. And I think I'm in good ground as somebody who enjoys a cocktail and is not ashamed about it. But yeah, something's weird is going on in Lynchburg.
In the category of things that are not really new, but I wanted to slow down and take note of it. In my newsletter today, which has the headline of "Addicted to BS," I talk about the fact that not a major event really in the great scheme of things. The President of the United States comes out after that big explosion in Beirut and says the generals tell me that it was an attack, which turns out that's very bad in imitation, but. It turns out that's not true. It was not an attack. And you know, look, that's not the point that he got it wrong, because this is not going to be, as I write, this is not really going to be, you know, in the top 1,000 of the weirdest moments of the Trump presidency. There are so many others, but it is worth just reflecting for a second on the fact that this is the man who has access to the most sophisticated intelligence in the world, and he's just winging it. He is just winning. And it's not just that he lies chronically and constantly. It's that he is addicted to the bullshit. He can't separate, you know, the wheat from the crap. He can't. There's something about the president. He doesn't process what's reliable information from what is just, you know, baseless speculation, which is like this whole story of our universe right now. And so, again, this is not the most important thing that's happening today, but you realize that
it's noteworthy, though. Like,
it is noteworthy, especially when Twitter and Facebook have decided to take down his comments. This is the president of the United States, because he was dishing out complete misinformation about the coronavirus, that children are completely immune from all of this. And Twitter and Facebook are saying, okay, we don't care what the American electorate thinks. This violates our standards. That's not what they said. I mean, but it violates our standard. We will find out whether it violates the standards of the American electorate, right?
Yeah, I mean, addicted to the bullshit is exactly the right phrase, Charlie. And you know, this reminds me of something that happened in a campaign, and obviously for us and most of those people listening to this podcast, you know, we all saw this coming, so we don't kind of need to do a victory lap, but. You know, he was exactly this person, right, on the campaign.
Always.
You know, and we all had this hope. Now, I didn't really have this hope, but many people had this hope that he would kind of grow into the job, right? And he starts getting these intelligence briefings and he'd start taking things more seriously and maybe even in kind of a gross way become enamored with the fact that he learns these important secrets before other people and that makes him feel important and fills the hole in his stomach from when his dad was mean to him. But he just can't. I forget if it was the Pulse shooting or San Bernardino, where, like, you know, 2 minutes after the news drops, he sends a tweet, you know, how radical Islamic terrorism, you know, and then, you know, a couple hours of the next day, you know, it's the FBI reports, you know, who the suspect is, and he tweets appreciate the congrats. You remember that? Like, he's like, thank you. I was so good at predicting this. So, you know, it's not like worried about the people who'd been killed in the terrorist attack or worried about getting it right or worried about finding the intelligence to know how we can respond to these things. It was like, it's talk radio Donnie. Like, I wanted to call into the show, predict what I think happened, and then have people get happy with me. And it's the same exact shit now, even when he can get the briefings.
So I never had the expectation that he was ever going to change. So in a lot of ways, though, my situation is worse because I was figuring, okay, so he's going to continue to do this. He's going to continue to, you know, throw the bullshit up against the wall. But the political world, including the Republican Party, would stand up and say, no, Mr. President, you can't do that. I actually lived in a universe, okay? be gentle with me here, Tim, because we haven't started the day drinking yet. In my alternative universe, I imagine that the president would say things that were completely false. Am I going to really say this? Am I going to just do this to myself? The president's going to say something completely untrue, completely full of it. And the Ron Johnsons of the world would stand up and say, no, you can't say that, Mr. President. That's not true. We need to maintain our credibility. I actually believe that. I believed at one point that you would have the Marco Rubios of the world stand up and say, you know, as my friend Ron Johnson just said, truth matters, facts matter, and there would be a pushback against this.
Well, and, you know,
okay,
our friend,
I'm sorry. I'm gonna
go, you know, I'm our friends in the more accommodationist right, you know, it's funny, I've said, you know, you're a nihilist for wanting to hold these guys accountable. But, like, it sounds to me like you were a person that actually thought, you know, maybe that something mattered, right? That there were some underlying beliefs here, and that if they, you know, refuse to even do the freaking bare minimum, to even do the bare minimum to say this is not appropriate, to try to encourage, you know, to get the correct information out there, to stand up to the president when he's wrong, to hold him accountable, like Marco said that he would in his re-election campaign. I do think that was reasonable, Charlie. I do. I think it was a reasonable ask, it's mind-boggling.
The word naive comes to mind. By the way, you may have sounded like I was laughing when I was talking about that. That was actually the sound of my soul leaving my body. So speaking of which, talk to me about Bill Hagerty. Bill Hagerty is Republican candidate for United States Senate in Tennessee. So for people wondering if this is going to get worse, it is going to get worse.
Yeah, it's going to get worse.
And he's on the ballot today. He's running for Lamar Alexander's speech. And as you point out, in 2019, as Hagerty was weighing a bid for the seat in the world's most annoying deliberative body, he went to see an old friend for advice about the race, Mitt Romney. And Hagerty goes way back with Mitt Romney. These guys are really good friends. Up until about 5 minutes ago. Tell me the story.
Yeah, I mean, I actually didn't know the story until yesterday morning. I knew a little bit about it from having worked with Romney in 12, knowing that Hagerty was a supporter. But, the Times, so I have to give Elena Plott credit for this, who wrote the story.
A great reporter.
She had uncovered this thing that really just pissed me off yesterday morning and forced me to want to make some calls and try to get to figure this out before the actual primary, which is held today in Tennessee. And her story said that Romney had given Hagerty a check, and Hagerty deposited the check, and then his consultants, I guess, freaked out, didn't report it against FEC rules, and they sent the check back. And then after that, Hagerty basically cut off his old friend and started trashing him in really personal terms. So I called some of my friends in Romney world and said, what's the deal with this? And they sent me some links and told me some old stories. And it turns out Hagerty knew Romney in the 80s. Romney helped, I think, guide him and give him a recommendation or something to get hired by Boston Consulting Group, where Romney had worked. They traveled in the same circles. Romney was a little older, but had become friends. Hagerty said in an interview in 2007 that he knew in the mid 80s that Mitt Romney was the kind of person who had the metal and had the DNA to be the president. So this is, this is not like DC friend, where you call everybody your friend who you just saw at parties. Like, they knew each other for 35 years going up to this, and Hagerty flips on him in personal and disgusting and smearing
vicious Romney. He didn't just return the money. He began viciously attacking Romney's character and his politics any time it came up. And you have a picture in your article, though, of what he gets for this, right? You basically throw Romney under the bus so you get a chance to appear with Don Jr. on Triggered.
Yeah, the Triggered podcast. I don't know if there's much overlap between the listeners to the Bulwark podcast and the Triggered podcast, but apparently that's a thing. And I suffered through 21 minutes of Bill Hagerty's appearance on the Triggered podcast for all of your guys' benefit. A quick side moment is, not only did Hagerty smear Romney, he does the whole obsequious, lavish praise of Trump stuff that is just like, this was a serious businessman. This was not a fake, phony businessman that Donald Trump, who didn't pay his vendors and called into the New York Post. Like, he was a real serious consultant at the highest levels. He says of Trump that, like, Donald Trump's a deal maker. He knows how to kind of get in a room and get people to yes and calm down tensions when things get a little too hot. I'm like, Donald Trump is calming down tensions. Hagerty's doing both these things, and his attacks on Romney, Charlie, like I said, you could imagine an alternate universe where this guy, in order to run for the Senate, is getting attacked for his old friend Romney. By the way, I don't want to let his opponent off the hook. Manny Sethi is an equally phony fake Trumper, I just didn't have the personal fire against him. But, Sethi's attacking him for being friends with Romney. And it's easy to imagine him saying, look, Mitt Romney's a good person. He's somebody I've known for 35 years. He's fought for Republican values. I disagree with him on Donald Trump. I disagree with him on his impeachment vote. I wish he would have voted differently. And if I go to the Senate, me and him, I'm sure we'll agree on some things and disagree on others. Like, is that hard to say? Was that really going to cost him this primary?
Apparently, yes. Right,
and that's the part because
apparently now it's required that you have to not just break with Romney, you have to smear him, called him somebody who was indistinguishable from Barack Obama, and saying he's just bitter after his loss, and then when he's busted on giving back the money, he says, well, it's because Romney is a liberal. And I mean, it's so. Yeah.
And then at the end, I get into his final thing, which is that he has no backbone. That we need somebody with a backbone in the Senate. And before I get to that, I want to get to this bitter attack. Okay. This is what the MAGA people all say about Romney. And they say it about us, right? That we're just mean to Donald Trump because we're bitter, because Jeb didn't win, or because Scott Walker didn't win, or because Mitt. And it's like, Bill Hagerty knows that's bullshit. You know why he knows that's bullshit? Because I talked to many people who said that after 2012, he went to Romney's yearly confab in Park City that Romney held every year with Republicans, where he helps people who are running for Senate raise money, and he helped advance conservative causes and raise money for those. Bill Hagerty went to all of those, and he ate the amuse-bouche, and he did the hike, the walks, and he stayed in the fancy hotel in Park City, and he lavishly praised Romney, and he sucked up to Romney and he talked about how good of a man Romney was. Romney wasn't bitter at these things. Romney was affable. You know, Romney was a person who thought he gave it his best shot and he lost. Sure, I'm sure he has some regrets, but Bill Hagerty knows that he's not lashing out against Donald Trump because of some bitterness. He knows Mitt Romney. He sat there in 2019 with him in Mitt Romney's office and asked him for advice on whether to run for president. And so to advance that lie on behalf is just this kind of sop to the MAGA crowd.
So this is what's happened to the Republican Party, though. I mean, it's a good example of it. So that let's take a time machine back to 2012. If you and I had met Bill Hagerty and talked to him about politics and his vision of the party, we might have thought he's one of the good guys. He's open-minded. He's thoughtful. This is not a stupid guy. He goes on to be the ambassador to Japan, right?
And he was part of the transition team, economic advisor, serious, thoughtful guy in that regard.
And now I'm looking at your piece, which is up at the Bulwark, and you have the picture, the screen grab of him sucking up to Don Jr. right above the tweet where he brags, proud to be endorsed by some of real Donald Trump's biggest fans and my good friends Diamond and Silk. Happy to have their support as we work for the America First agenda. So here's a guy who has gone from somebody that you and I probably would have thought was pretty much okay to being deep into, I mean, just beyond MAGA stuff. I mean, the guy basically has just sold off his gonads so that he can pose for a picture with Diamond and Silk. And so this is what's been happening to the Republican Party, and it's happening right now, even as everything is falling apart. This is what you have to do. This is, in order to survive in this Republican Party, in the Tennessee Republican Party, which, by the way, gave us Marsha Blackburn in the United States Senate.
Also gave us Howard Baker and Lamar Alexander, and
you've gone from Howard Baker to Marsha Blackburn. You've gone from Lamar Alexander to this ass kissing toady.
Yeah, and that's and like you said, I'm sure the liberals that are listening to this are like, you guys are so stupid. I could have seen this coming, that this guy was a hack. And maybe that's true. But yeah, I mean, he was a normal, just kind of regular business Chamber of Commerce Republican. And this is what Trump has done. Even when he's in the 30s, these guys are still sticking with it. And that's what took me to the kind of final thing that I wrote in the article, which was his final attack on, his attack on Romney, is that we need somebody with backbone in the Senate. We need somebody with backbone. Mitt Romney doesn't have the backbone to stand up to the Black Lives Matter protesters. That's what his take is. It's like, fuck you.
The Black Lives Matter protesters. Yeah. Okay, so your previous article, you wrote about the unreality force field around the president, which I probably should have gotten to when we were talking about it being addicted to bullshit. By the way, we're definitely getting the explicit rating on this podcast. I think you've already given us the rating with Rick Wilson didn't yesterday. But this is part of the extraordinary thing about this president. And you were talking about the Jonathan Swan interview where he did this masterful job of exposing for anybody that was willing to watch that the president just does not understand or is completely impervious to actual information. So that people keep saying, you do spin, but sooner or later reality reasserts itself, like with the coronavirus and what's happening. What I think we saw is that the president has created this force field that protects him from any inconvenience from reality.
Yeah, and before I get to that, in case your listeners have missed it, I just do have to read the Onion headline about this interview, which was DC journalists in awe of Australian reporters' ability to speak to Trump without succumbing to his raw animal magnetism. Jonathan Swan did such a great job with this interview, and it is alarming that 3.5 years in, like, reporters are finally learning, you know, some of these obvious tricks with talking to Trump, like maybe asking a follow-up question. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, we're saying, hey, no, that's completely wrong. Yeah. Well, this is what's interesting. I don't know if you saw Oliver Darcy's piece on CNN, where he talks about how enraging it was. It was enraging because for years, well-compensated professional television news anchors have failed to execute interviews half as effective as Swan's. Bill Hemmer, Brett Baer, David Murr, Chuck Todd. Each of those anchors had their opportunities to sit down with the president, but none of them produced an interview as revealing as the one that aired Monday on Axios on HBO. Yeah, it was. One hopes that Jonathan Swan's performance will inspire some better journalism, but I mean, it really did show up that if you challenge the president, he doesn't handle it well.
It is, well, yeah. I mean, if you just make him follow up with facts, he doesn't handle it well. And you know, I think the virus has really exposed that. And that's what I, you know, kind of got into in the unreality force field thing. And I used an analogy because I thought it was important to use this metaphor because in I'm sure you did this on your podcast or on your radio show, Charlie. I certainly wrote it in speeches for many of the candidates I worked for. For 8 years, we attacked Barack Obama for not saying radical Islamic terrorism. Yes, right. And the reason, and what was the reason for that, at least in our heads, at least in my head? The reason for that was President Obama wasn't, the fact that he wasn't saying radical Islamic terrorism meant that he didn't really fully grasp the threat that faced us.
Right. Now, you needed to name it in order to fight it. That was the point.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought that was a reasonable point. I think it turns out most of the Republicans who were making that point were really just saying that they wanted the president to say brown people bad, but and Donald Trump channeled their loathing and their grievance and their anger. But the overall point that one needs to recognize their foe, to what their foe is, to defeat it, is still a salient one, even if it didn't really apply in that case, even if in that case it was BS. And this is the deal with the virus. And if you look at the Swan interview, you see a president that doesn't understand his foe, isn't willing to recognize what its true nature is, isn't willing to say what it is because he is selling himself on this BS, because he's selling himself on this, on, you know, these fake cures like hydroxychloroquine, you know, and because he's an old salesman who thinks that he can talk his way out of this and tabloid his way out of this, and his staff isn't breaking the force field. You know, his staff is giving him these childish charts, you know, for like a 2-year-old, and asking them and saying, see, things are good, Mr. President, everything's right. Fine, look at how much better we're doing than the other kids. And so you know, because of that, he is not only unprepared to solve this problem, but he's also unprepared to handle an interview where somebody asks him about the basic facts, you know, repeatedly, because he hasn't taken in what the basic facts are, because he's living in this unreality force field. He doesn't understand what the challenge is.
It's why he can't pivot, and why I think this whole school reopening thing is going to be a political fiasco for him. There's a new poll out showing that American parents are ambivalent at best about sending their kids back to school. This also raises the question about the debates. I mean, just to segue to the debates, because I think this is fascinating. You saw that his folks put out a stunt yesterday, saying they want to have an early debate, and they came up with a list of 24 personalities that they suggested as moderators. I mean, it's a hell of a list. I think it was the Daily Beast said it's loaded with many of the president's favorite right wing pundits and Fox News personalities, including Rachel Campos Duffy, a Fox News contributor, former Real World cast member, and a Wisconsinite.
Poor Nora O'Donnell. What did she do to get put on that list?
You know, this is a great point. How embarrassing. If you go through that list, if you're like a legitimate journalist and you're on that list, you really have to ask yourself, like, what did I do? You need to re-examine your life choices.
They threw out like three, you know, quote-unquote serious reporters, David Muir, Major Garrett, who I can understand why they'd want those two guys. Yeah. But, you know, and then Nora gets dumped in there. I felt bad for Nora. I was like, I don't, maybe she was too nice to Kaylee one time in a private conversation. I don't know.
Well, who knows? I mean, you can just imagine they're just sitting around the room, you know, throwing names up, up against the wall. I mean, it was embarrassing. But, you know, this is a point that Dave Weigel from the Washington Post has made, that and I'm thinking about how badly the president has performed in his recent interviews. I mean, it was Chris Wallace was terrible, you know, followed up by Jonathan Swan and various other things. The notion somehow that he would be an effective debater against Joe Biden because Joe Biden would pass out and drool on the podium. Really, what they've done is they've set the expectations so low for Joe Biden that all Joe Biden needs to do is show up and be reasonably coherent, and he wins. I mean, they are playing the expectations game, I think, horribly.
Yeah, I mean, has there ever been a debate where both candidates have the expectations game is so low for both sides? I mean, it's a challenging math equation to see who has a lower expectation set for them, because Trump has set such low expectations for both himself and his opponent in this one. And I think that like there is a misremembering of Trump's performances against Hillary. Because he won the election, people have rejiggered history and the narrative to kind of argue that he did a good job. He was insane in all three debates against Hillary, and Hillary was just totally fine. I mean, she didn't knock anything out of the park, but it was totally fine. I don't know what their game plan is with this, and this whole shtick that is going around conservative media right now, which shows just how desperate they are for anything to attack Joe Biden on, because they're so lost in this campaign right now, that like Biden is wants to hide from the debates or isn't trying to debate. It's just like made up out of nothing. I mean, like every time Biden's asked, he's like, yeah, sure, I'll debate three times. Great. I was like, sounds good. And like Fox is spending segment after segment about how Joe Biden's scared, you know, to debate, you know, Rambo Trump. It just doesn't make any sense, like strategically or in fact.
No, it is made up. The only hard part might be for Joe Biden and for any other sentient human being to stand on the stage and go through the gaslighting. That at a certain point you go, no, that's just not true. No, that's not true. That's you can't say, you can't do what Jonathan Swan did, when just to kind of roll your eyes and go, no, you can't do that. Your numbers are wrong, or what we do, and say that's complete bullshit. I mean, after a while, you know, Donald Trump might just throw out so much crap that what they're hoping that what Biden's just going to lose it, you know.
Yeah, and the big advantage that Trump does have in a debate over Biden, and you know, we can go deeper into this once we get closer, but is something to think about is like he does have a lizard brain for like the Fox News little micro facts and scandals, and so he will probably know more about Burisma and Hunter Biden's, you know, consulting career than Hunter's own dad does. You know, like he will really know all the intricacies of that and Obamagate and, you know, unmasking. And so while he doesn't know anything about, you know, the deaths per million of people that he's overseeing, as Jonathan Swan shows, he will know, you know, the details of some of that. And I don't know. I think that could put Biden in a tough kind of defensive.
This is
crouch.
This is a very good point, because he will be able to throw that stuff out. And as part of this lizard brain is also the complete lack of conscience. Is that other people might say, okay, I'm not going to go after the you know, your children. Children ought to be, you know, off limits, particularly with Joe Biden's background, having lost two children, the tragedy in his life. Donald Trump looks at that completely differently. He will look at that as like, this is the vulnerability. I'm going to try to turn the humanity and the empathy and the pain of Joe Biden against me. And quite frankly, we all have that hot button. I mean, there's always that one thing that if somebody says this, we're going to lose our temper, right? Everybody's got it, and it's different. And if people, you know, haven't ever been in this circumstance Trust me, there is something that somebody will say about your child or about someone you love or about something that is false about you. And that's the trigger. And Donald Trump doesn't have the normal human conscience to not press that button. And so if I'm around Joe Biden, I do see that as a vulnerability. I mean, not by the way, that's not a criticism of Joe Biden. That's just an acknowledgement that he's going to have to be prepared to listen to the worst possible thing about, you know, one of your children.
And yeah, Trump is so desperate. I mean, that's where they're going to go. I mean, you can just see with how they've been flailing, you know, with their attacks against Biden over the past month, and you know, now with the new campaign manager, have kind of continued to plunge new depths. Certainly by the fall, they'll be ready to, you know, go after Biden's kids.
Yeah, but to do it in person is different. Yeah. Okay, so the Kanye West thing, have you followed this story? This is a Wisconsin story. So it's a great story in and of itself, but you know, since everything about Wisconsin is interesting to me, I just find this fascinating that the Trump folks are not even going through the motions of pretending that they are not the ones behind putting Kanye West's name on the ballot in Wisconsin. So this woman, this conservative Republican activist lawyer named Lane Ruland, she worked for the Trump campaign. She delivered ballots, you know, and she's the one who shows up to deliver the Kanye West ballot signatures to Wisconsin election officials on behalf of Kanye West this week. She shows up. Cameras catch her. Obviously, they knew. So the Trump folks are, you know, saying, yeah, absolutely, we want to put Kanye West on the ballot in Wisconsin because we think that's going to drain votes from Joe Biden.
I will be very interested in the, you know, long form New York Magazine article and what is happening behind the scenes of this. It's a mystery. And it's like, are these people talking to Kanye? You know, I mean, you have to know something crazy is going on behind the scenes here, because who's funding this? You know, how are they, you know, it's not easy to get, you know, 5,000 petition signatures.
I think it's incredibly unsubtle. Now, of course, I mean, this comes, you know, as, you know, Kanye's wife. I'm actually going to say Kardashian for the first time on the podcast. You know, she says her husband's, you know, struggling with mental illness. And so, I mean, it's pretty obvious to anybody, you know, what's going on with him. But I think the Trump folks are just that cynical. And here's the real cynicism.
Right, but is he directing this? Like, are they on conference calls with Kanye?
I don't think he has anything to do with it. I just think they think, hey, black celebrity, let's put him on the ballot in Wisconsin. And black voters in Milwaukee might vote for Kanye West instead of Joe Biden, which the contempt for the intelligence of the voters is so profound. To imagine that there are African-American voters who will show up at the polls and think, you know, I could vote for Joe Biden to defeat Donald Trump, but it would be so radical to vote for Kanye West. Trying to imagine who that voter is, but obviously
folks, Maggie story that was about conservatives, but it's also relevant to black voters about Trump's just sort of fantasy land view of what like regular Christians want. Like, they'll be happy if I hold up this Bible after gassing some priests, you know, outside the White House. You know, they'll be happy if I stand up for the Confederate monuments. These Southerners, they must love Confederates. And, you know, these black people, they must like Kanye, right? He's a rapper. Like, we can give that to them. I mean, it is a blunt force instrument, like, over and over, because, you know, he doesn't have actual any real world insight into what Christian conservatives really believe, or what Kanye really believes, or what black voters really believe.
He's 30 seconds away from posting a picture of himself holding a basketball, because that will connect with black voters. I mean, he is that close to all this. Didn't he appear on that Catholic network, EWTN, or whatever it was, Eternal Word? Yeah, is it EWTN? Eternal Word? Whatever. And he's talking about his appeal to Catholic voters and saying, and you Catholics really care about the Second Amendment too, because of course the gospel according to the NRA is really important to American Catholics. That's another one of those examples where he's sort of got this cartoon image of his head. Okay, Christians out there, what do they like? Guns, right?
Yeah, and I wrote about this in the Barstool article about black voter, about, you know, the what the conservative voters want too, where he was doing this interview with this kind of bro-y, college bro-y, you know, Barstool Sports host, and you know, it's anti-PC guy, and you know, you can tell Trump thinks that he's like in his wheelhouse here, and he's going to be able to sort of attack the Black Lives Matter protesters and like talk about how they're thugs, and the Barstool guy's kind of like, you know, I mean, I was against Kaepernick at first, but like, what's the harm with kneeling? I mean, it seems like it's a better deal than looting. And you know, Trump is totally taken aback by this. Like, he just goes on this very lengthy ramble, you know, which I quoted at length in the article if you want to read it. And, you know, he doesn't even know what to say. Like, he thought that, you know, he just assumed that it's like, oh, it's these anti-PC guys that, like, my son, that Don Jr. really likes. Like, they're going to be happy. You know, he's going to be happy with my, you know, with the fact that I'm triggering the libs with this attack on the athletes. He's not in touch with that. And it worked in the primary, I think, in large part because he had these rallies and he was able to kind of test drive material.
Well, remember, this is a guy that actually thinks that Charlie Kirk is the authentic voice of the younger generation.
I'm a little concerned he might be. That he might be the authentic voice of the younger conservative generation. This is a maybe post-election bulwark takeout from me, but I'm a little concerned about that.
This is another good point, though, is that the lack of his rallies does cut him off from his feedback loop. Because I think, you know, it is true that what he would do is he would test drive an idea. And if he got a big cheer for it, that's what the people wanted. If he didn't get a big cheer, he would drop it. He's got no feedback loop. And the loss of his rallies is huge. The loss of this convention, which, by the way, I don't.
Just really quick on the rallies before the convention. Yeah. I think that the Confederate monument thing would have gone away with the rallies. I don't think it would have been a big applause line. And if you listen to people who worked on his campaign in 2016, they say that after his rallies, that's all he would talk about on the plane back is what did they cheer for? You know, what's working? I mean, he was very conscious of the audience. He's a showman, right? You know, and you know, who knows, I guess, what the audience would have done to the with these kind of Confederate monument lines, but it's possible that he kind of got down this rabbit hole because of his cartoonish view of his fan base, and actually, you know, he might have saved himself from it had he been having the rallies.
Well, I don't know. Well, we will never know. But the loss of the convention, which, I mean, I do not lament the loss of conventions, even though I've been to them in the past. But for him, you know, I mean, this was the ultimate show for Donald Trump, you know, to have the balloon drop and the big crowds and the big, you know, podium and all of that, you know, the arena packed with screaming MAGA heads. The fact that everybody's sort of focusing on the fact that he's now talking about giving his acceptance speech from the White House, which I think he's going to back off from. I mean, he was sort of tentative about it. Nobody's supporting it. It's obviously a bad idea. But it's also kind of a sign of how isolated the guy is, because for him to give the speech from what the private quarters of the White House, that's a huge loss because there's no big screaming crowd, right? I mean, he's like run out of venue. You're the president of the United States and you run out of venues.
It's going to affect his mental state too. Look, any campaign, I was always down on a campaign I was on, I'd get out of the headquarters, go to an event where you meet real people who actually like your candidate, and, you know, get off the internet, and it's good for your soul, right?
Very much.
Trump needs this even more than anyone, and so not getting that feedback, sitting in, you know, his you know, lonely office watching his super DVR, you know, it's going to make him even more crazy and act out even more. I think that's true. Another just funny side note on the convention thing that I saw this morning, I guess John Thune expressed a little bit of concern. I don't know how this came up. John Thune never criticizes Trump, but apparently he expressed a little bit of maybe uncertainty about whether it's a Hatch Act violation to do the convention from the Oval Office or from the White House, in a conversation with a reporter. A reporter relayed that to Trump, and Trump said, "Is that a Democrat or a Republican?" I swear, I did not see this morning. And it's like, he didn't know, the great negotiator doesn't even know, you know, can't even name the 53 Republican senators. I just, how embarrassing for John Thune. I found that to be an amusing side note that lifted my spirits this morning.
An amusing side note, because, you know, by the time we're done with this podcast, the White House will be saying, well, of course the president knew, he was joking. This is the president's famous sense of humor, that he was just kidding when he said we should postpone the election. You wrote about that as well, the whole Trumpist sense of humor, which is like in the middle of a pandemic and an economic downturn, for the president to be joking about delaying the election is hilarious, right?
He's such a card, that Donald Trump, and his comedy's so good. We're always laughing at him. So wonderful. This is a little trick they've been using for a while now. Anytime he says something embarrassing that doesn't land, it's a joke. There was a very, I linked to it in the article. I'd recommend you watching. Breonna Keeler at CNN did a very, a poignant interview with Tim Murtaugh, who's the campaign spokesperson, who at that time the shtick was that Trump had been joking about stopping the testing.
This is funny.
And,
yeah.
And Breonna just keeps saying, so what's the joke here? Anytime you have to explain a joke, it's not funny.
Why is this funny? People are dying. Explain the funny part of this.
Where is the humor here? And Tim's like, well, there's an iron. Isn't it ironic to say, that you would slow down the testing? So, many of these times, the famous Donald Trump humor is just, it's just the excuse mechanism. The defenders of Donald Trump, still 3.5 years later, put themselves in these situations where they have to, where he pulls the rug out from under them. They say it's a joke. He says, no, I'm serious. Right. Ari Fleischer was out there saying how absurd it was that Joe Biden would say that Donald Trump might suggest to postpone the election. Donald Trump suggests to postpone the election. Say, oh, that's a joke. Donald Trump says, no, not joking. Actually, I'm serious. We might have to do it. This is their the only defense mechanism these people have to defend the indefensible.
No, it is, and it's incredibly lame. I mean, it is the part of that. I think part of the stress of all of this is that everything feels like we're back in junior high, and the world is being run by the dumbest kids in junior high. So I think that's part of the stress. By the way, great job, Tim, the Republican Voters Against Trump. I think somebody described us as sharing the same DNA, but I have to say that the string of ads, and these, for people who haven't seen them, I hope everybody who's listening to this has seen them. These are testimonial ads. They're not highly polished. They are real people explaining why they have decided they're not going to vote for Donald Trump. I think they are incredibly powerful. In fact, I think this is one of the things about, this is in your wheelhouse. I think that sometimes those of us who follow politics are overly impressed by the really slick ads that may just sort of reinforce where you were at. These ads seem so carefully tailored to exactly the kinds of voters who are on the bubble. And I guess the question that I get asked more and more is, are those people actually seeing them, or are we preaching to the choir with those testimonials?
Yeah, we're trying to get people to see them, and anybody can chip in if they want at rvat.org and help us. We're up. We did an ad with veterans out yesterday that I thought was really powerful. It was 15 veterans talking about why they can't support Donald Trump and about his weakness. And how he's abandoned them with the bounties and other issues. And we're airing that in Pennsylvania on TV. And then digitally across these swing states, we're just mindful of, we have a very small target audience, that we're trying to get to, which is people like us. No, actually, maybe not people like us, really. People like some of the pundits that we criticize on this podcast, right? Yeah. These voters that went for Trump last time but didn't like him. They held their nose for him, but they're looking at this. They're looking at his management of the virus. They're looking at his management of the racial strife in the country. And they're just like, I just don't know if I can do it with this guy. They need the boost from people like them. They need permission from friends, from people in their community to say, okay, I can pull the plug on this guy and still be a Republican and still be a conservative. And so we're trying to find those people on Facebook and YouTube and promote these ads to them in a very targeted manner. If you don't mind, just a quick aside, yep. The thing that has been, I've been grateful to be able to do it. I think it's a very cool project. The coolest part for me has been, it's just so moving listening to some of these people. I mean, yes. You can tell this has been weighing on, you know, in addition to the ad side of things, there's the testimonial side and just the support group function of it. It's almost like AA, you know, where people can come to this, our YouTube page, come to our site and hear from other people like them. And you can just feel their pain. You know, they're like, being Republican was part of their identity. You know, being a person of character and values was, you know, being a part of the party that was of character and values was part of their identity. And this guy is stomping on it and all their friends are going along with it. And so you can feel their pain, and it's been really cool to hear from them. And just today, my quick plug is at 3:30 Eastern, you know, I'm doing a live kind of little round table with a couple of these people who voted for Trump last time and changed their mind and came out, and explained why, and you know, they'll talk about how they've lost some friends over it, but on the other side, it's worked because they've heard from people who were like, man, I needed to hear that from you. So I think it'll be pretty cool, and that I've been really moved by all of these folks' stories, and it's on all the platforms, Twitter and Facebook and YouTube this afternoon.
Oh, I find it fascinating to see these folks, because I feel like I know these people, and I know that they're talking to the people that I know. Are a lot of these coming like over the transom? Are people just sending you these videos?
Well, yeah. On the front end, we have a bunch of, you know, really hardworking, awesome folks behind the scenes who kind of worked to get the first 100 and like really went out and recruited them. But since then, the vast majority have just come out of the transom. People, you know, word of mouth. People saw it on social media, said I wanted to do it. People, you know, saw me blabbing my mouth on MSNBC and were like, I should do this too. People who had a couple cocktails and saw it. And we're scrolling, doom scrolling on the internet, and was like, yeah, I need to tell the story. And so it's been pretty cool. And we went, like I said, we worked to get the first 100, and now we're over 500. And most of the last 400 have come in just organically, which has been really cool.
And what's impressive about them is that these are very articulate people, and they are very, very thoughtful. And this is, you know, there are so many things out there that are, you know, destroy your faith in humanity permanently. But then these, you watch them and you go, these are smart people. And the interesting thing about them is that a lot of them, well, I mean, again, they're when I say they're not polished, that's not a criticism of the spot. It makes it more authentic. And you do get that sense of sincerity that they have something that they want to say, and they finally found a place to say it. So these things are absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, if you just want to watch one to this regard, one came in off the transom yesterday, and I don't even want to try to do this guy justice. Like he needs to have our job, Charlie. This guy Matthew, who is just a you look at the picture and you're like, this guy's got to be a Trumper, and he's got a handlebar mustache, and he speaks so eloquently about his faith and how he actually thinks that Donald Trump was sent by God, but to expose our weaknesses. It is just this raw and moving video that just came in, I think 2 days ago, just off the wire. And so if you go to the site and you can search through Georgia, it's the latest one out of Georgia.
The latest one, his name is Matthew.
Yeah. Matthew from Georgia. So cool.
Tim Miller, thank you once again for coming on the podcast. Appreciate it very much. Make sure you go ahead and read Tim's piece in the Bulwark today about the spineless Tennessee politician. It is it's an indication of the times we live in. It may seem like an old story, but I have to say I was infuriated and raised my blood pressure all over again. So Tim, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.